Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keen. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Dan Edwards and I know we are as good as our team, and our team sometimes, well, they do things because they're brilliant, and also the surveillance team, sometimes you get lucky. We did that before December 31st when we said, Tony Cosenzi, you need to start our year, and then we enjoyed December 31st where things fell out of bed. Cosenzi's at PIMCO. He's definitive on short-term paper. Bring up the chart over here, McKinnon, if you would. This is the, I've never shown this chart before. I'm only doing this because Cosenzi showed up at an early hour. 1 year, 2 year difference in yield. And you've got the oddities before the crisis and then the normality of the difference in yield between a 2 year and a 1 year, and we fell off a cliff. Tony Cosenzi, let's start with the why of the short-term paper market. Why is the 1 year, 2 year yield inverted where 1 year yields are higher than 2 year yields?
This is a crystal ball. It's telling you about the future and what the market thinks of the Fed and what it will do with its policy rate. We know the Fed in December raised its policy rate to 2.25, 2.5.
Right.
Here the market's saying it'll go back below 2 at some point.
Are they predicting a rate cut at some point?
The market is predicting a rate cut at the beginning part of next year. So we won't be roaring into the 20s like we did 100 years ago. We could be stumbling into the 20s is what the market is saying.
What everybody wants to know on Global Wall Street from you is when we talk commercial paper or LIBOR OIS and the other arcane stuff that you and Jerome Schneider and others at PIMCO look at every day. Okay, great. Is it a liquidity crisis? Is it a tension within the corporate space?
Absolutely not a liquidity crisis. There's still over $1 trillion of extra money that banks could utilize to keep themselves liquid. Banks are in exceptionally good shape today.
What about shadow banking?
Still, many worry about it, but there aren't the excesses there that many people cite. What is concerning is that this all began in markets, the stress, with political factors, not macroeconomic ones. It was related to Brexit. It was related to Italy. It was related to trade stories. Now what markets have to worry about is the feedback loop, where what happened in markets because of politics starts to feed back into the real economy and then back into the markets. So it's one of the major questions for this year is whether we can get past the 10th year of expansion in June, making it a record dating back to the mid-1800s, or not. Will we stumble into the 20s or roar like 100 years ago? It looks like we may stumble, but there's a lot that could happen that changes things. When there's a sense of pessimism, of course, it's an accumulation period. One should be thinking about building assets, but be careful. Very careful about that.
Okay, Tony, good morning to you. So if this inversion at the very short end then is telling us something kind of gloomy about where we'll be roaring or stumbling into the 20s, what kind of lag does this normally deliver then? When you look at the short end of the curve, what kind of lag does this kind of signal usually require?
Well, it depends. Markets will tend to be correct on this, but only, let's say, 9 months would be a period where it has pristine accuracy. One looking out a year or two, not so great. Think about a year ago, markets of the Fed would put its policy rate potentially at around 3%. Now, instead of the rate hikes that would stay in place through 2020 and even 2021, markets think there'll be a rate cut. So it shows you that looking past 1 year out becomes a bit precarious. And so this forecast that markets have today for an interest rate cut may not be correct. But is it that important anyway? The global story in interest rates is quite benign. Look at the German Bund today, the 10-year, 0.15%. There are trillions of dollars, near $10 trillion of bonds globally, negative yielding. So the worry in markets today has very little to do with interest rates and the Fed's rate hikes. It has a lot to do with the other factors I mentioned. I think one final point of Brexit. The Bank of England said the UK economy could shrink 8% in the case of a hard Brexit. And so there are numerous other things markets are concerned about that need to be resolved and before this feedback loop starts to hit the economy and markets again.
Do you think the Fed should pause here, Tony?
There is a very strong case for the Fed pausing at the March meeting when the next rate hike potentially could occur, as many have postulated. Financial conditions do matter. The transmission of monetary policy occurs through five channels. It's stock prices, bond yields, credit spreads, the dollar, and bank lending standards. And all these combined today suggest the U.S. economy will be weaker this year than otherwise.
Let's come back. Tony Cosenzi with us. Without question, our conversation of the day. I'm going to look to the terminal and tell you Tony Cosenzi's lifted the market here in the last 10 minutes. What's great about Freya Bamish with Pantheon in England is she has lived China. She's not only been there, but attempts Mandarin. So can you order a pizza in Mandarin, Freya? Are you to the point where your Mandarin is so good you can order a pizza to go?
I'm not a fan of Chinese pizza, but yeah, I can order something.
Okay, well, we got
to... Tom, honestly, you go to Shanghai or Beijing and order pizza? Really?
Well, yes, yeah, sure, that's what I would do. Anyways, Freya, good morning. What is the thing you're searching in China GDP after the comments of President Xi over the last 3 or 4 days? He's made some speeches. I think they're below the radar. But what is the data thing that you're trying to observe to gauge where China is?
Well, I guess the PMIs that we had out this morning were pretty unpleasant. I think the consensus was always a little bit high on that, especially we had the official out already. But in terms of the report itself and the kind of breakdowns that we had there, it was telling us that the employment situation is still quite shaky. We've still got producer price inflation slowing, and that feeds through obviously to the massive industrial sector and is a massive deterrent on future production. The good news, I think we're all very focused at this stage on the bad news, and certainly I'm not kind of jumping on any kind of good news bandwagon, but I think it is relevant at this stage to point out a few kind of good news elements from the data that we're seeing at the moment. I think, first of all, the PMI is probably going to trough above where we saw in 2015. So that 2015 was the last kind of 2014 was the last kind of real kind of significant downturn that we had in China. I think we'll probably trough above that this time. The bad news is that we still have some further deterioration to go before we get there. The leading indicators have kind of leveled off. We're starting to see the kind of the most advanced leading indicators are pointing towards a pickup in the second half of the year, but we still have some further deterioration to go before then in the PMIs and in the GDP data, although the headlines might not actually show that. So we've got some good news out there. We've certainly got stimulus in the pipeline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not really coming through yet at the overall level. We've got our kind of infrastructure. We've got our Xi Jinping and the work conference that we had at the end of last year, which sets out the policy direction for this year. We had an important revelation there that there'll be increase in the quota for local government bond issuance, and that's where we get our infrastructure growth going from again. And I think actually there is probably still room for a bit of a rate cut, which would probably enhance the efficacy of the measures that they made, the targeted lending facility measures that they introduced at the end of last year. So there's stimulus there,
right.
There's stimulus potentially more coming through. And I think probably on the trade front as well, we can be a little bit positive in that sense as well.
Well, let's start with the policy tools they've got available to them, and then we can talk about the trade negotiations. You mentioned the slowdown in 14-15 that bled into 16 as well. That slowdown was accompanied with some real policy shocks, and one of them was around the currency. Freya, do you see the stage set for something similar again, or is it very different this time?
I think there's enough time for the PBOC to get a little bit scared in the first half that things are not turning around. I think, as I said, the stimulus is actually in the pipeline, but the lag seems to be a little bit longer this time around than previously, and that leaves the PBOC and policymakers in the position of having to kind of sit on their hands and wait until the stimulus comes through, and I'm not sure that they'll be willing to do that. So I think we will probably see a rate cut or something that is effectively like a rate cut. It might not be an actual publicized rate cut, but there'll be something that will help to loosen monetary conditions further. And that obviously exerts a downward pressure on the renminbi. But we are in a changed situation here with regards to the Fed. It's not looking likely anymore that they'll hike in March, and that gives the PBOC a little bit more room there. And also, as I said, when we get to talk about the trade deal, that will release a little bit of pressure of depreciation pressure from the renminbi. So it gives them a little bit more room there. But I think there's definitely the potential for the PBOC to kind of surprise markets with a bit more of a stimulus.
So Frey, you brought up trade, so let's talk about it. It's clear to me that there's an incentive for President Xi Jinping to come to the table and try and strike a deal with the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Frey, what's not clear to me is the concessions that President Xi is willing to make. What are those concessions?
Well, the in the policy setting meeting that we had at the end of last year, you don't get a lot of detail in that kind of a readout, but there was one sentence which said that they were going to prioritize the agreement, reaching the agreement and implementing the agreement that was made at the G20 meeting in November. So that's a good sign to start with, at least rhetorically. But they've also made moves in the direction of cutting tariffs. They've restarted, or they've kind of signaled that they're about to restart imports from the U.S., which they actually have pulled back on very sharply in the second half. And also they've critically made kind of rumblings in the right direction with regard to the forced technology transfer.
I like in your research note your knock-on effect to South Korea as well. What are the adjacency effects of this supposed slowdown in China?
Yeah, I think we've seen it. We often see it actually first in some of the Korean data, because Korea's sitting at the head of the supply chain, and they also happen to publish very early in the data calendar. So definitely we've seen a slowdown in Korean export volumes. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of noise there because of changing holidays and that kind of thing. But the overall trend is one of weakness from Korea. Yeah. We're starting to see that feed through to Japan as well. So there's definitely the evidence there that these economies are struggling as a result of China's slowdown.
Alfreda, have a great new year, and we really, really look forward to catching up with you in Shanghai at DeMarco Pizza, 1F Golden Bridge Garden.
Oh, you're selling it.
103 Dong.
What's the highlight on the menu?
I didn't ask, but there's a lot of pizza places in Shanghai. I didn't know that.
I really should do Shanghai with you. It sounds like you have a really different experience over there.
It's a different experience.
To what many other people would experience
that would be
there.
True. Priya Beamish, thank you so much with Pantheon on China. Serious news there out of China. Joining us now, Dana Peterson with Citigroup, their North American economist. Dana, if I look at the Citigroup call, have you people amended or adjusted your outlook for next year in the last two or three days?
No, we haven't. We still expect that the Fed is going to be raising rates at least a couple of times this year, potentially in March. And certainly the impasse in the federal government is not going to be a major determining factor in the Fed delaying any of its activities for this year.
Will tightening financial conditions be a big factor?
Well, I mean, financial conditions have tightened a little bit, but they're still quite loose. But I'm certain that the Fed is going to be watching that, along with all the other economic indicators it pays attention to when it's doing its monetary policy calculus.
Well, at the moment, the only economic indicators that continues to surpass the economic expectations of the economists are the labor market and the household sector. Everything else is deeply negative and disappointing, Danny. Do you see that turning around anytime soon?
Well, I mean, when I look at certainly the fourth quarter, the economy still grew pretty robustly in the 2.5% to 3% range. Some of the most recent economic indicators have been a little bit weak, but the Fed is looking at inflation. The Fed is looking at certainly the labor market and also, you know, overall GDP. And still on most of those fronts, we're doing well. I mean, we do anticipate some weakening of inflation, certainly because oil prices are falling, and also you have some other underlying factors, and certainly that might cause the Fed to consider fewer hikes this year.
as you perceive it as an economist, are the market, this has been my theme for this morning, I don't hate to bore people, but do you see markets as rational and normal with their new volatility, or are there discontinuities here that get your attention?
Sure. I think, the different markets are reacting for different reasons. Certainly, the bond market is concerned about the yield curve flattening and what signals that gives us. I would suggest that maybe this time is a little bit different. We haven't had QE in the past, kind of muddling the signals from the yield curve. But certainly, the equity market has been very weak. I think some of that's just a little bit of a steam coming out, but also concerns about the global economy as well as
right.
The trade dispute.
So then what do you see within your North American purview of Y equals C plus I plus G plus net X? I mean, is this all about the trade war, or are there investment and consumption dynamics that are leading to these instabilities?
Sure, I think consumption is still being supercharged by tax reform, but we are concerned about investment. Indeed, with the equity market weakening, that's certainly the signal for our investors. And certainly with respect to CapEx, the businesses are not going to have another big injection from tax reform this year, and you still have concerns about trade.
Yeah, I guess, Dana, with one final question then today, you say you haven't changed the Citigroup view. What is your view on Fed calls? Because what we're hearing from guest after guest is a January 30 meeting has very suddenly become important.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've always had a March hike, and we did not have a hike in January, but certainly January is going to be important for how the Fed sees the economy, whether they're overly, rather more concerned about weakening inflation, if they're more concerned about weakening in China, and certainly the trade outlook for the U.S. And so I definitely think that's going to be a very important meeting that we should be looking at.
Dana, thank you so much. Dana Peterson with Citigroup. We have been remiss, and it's importantly been remiss, with the sobering idea, Pim Fox, of how wrong so many got the transformation in Brazil when Mr. Lula came on board. It was, I say this in every speech I ever give, it was one of the great missed calls I made. I was incredibly wrong about the Brazilian economy, their resiliency under political change. And Pim, here we are again.
With more political change in
here we are
Brazil.
Again. I'm
with
sober
a new government.
Right now.
All right.
Bring in, Pim, I'll let you bring
all
in.
All right. Well, this all has to do, of course, with the new government of Mr. Bolsonaro, President Bolsonaro, taking office in the inauguration. And he's set to announce a variety of economic measures, the design, cut red tape, and also fight retirement benefit fraud while leaving pension reform for later on. Here to tell us about what's going on in the country, Oscar Decotelli, the chief executive of DXA Investment. Oscar Decotelli, tell us a little bit about President Bolsonaro and what you believe his agenda includes.
Hi, Pim. Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me. I think we're starting off a new year, a new administration. The Bolsonaro government brings definitely a mentality of trying to reduce the size of the government with 22 ministries only, with a mentality also of trying to reduce the whole corruption around the government, what we've seen in these last years, but also trying to bring a new agenda of bringing growth back to the country. And I think for all of us here, we're quite hopeful that this is going to become a reality, but there are definitely some challenges to face in the next 100 days, right?
What are some of the specific measures that the government needs to get right and get right quickly?
Yeah, sure. I think the first thing is that about 90% of the government expenditure are defined by the Constitution. And for that matter, there's not a lot of room to be able to change unless you go through a very kind of a bureaucratic process of voting through the Congress and the Senate. So what I think we're going to be able to see in the short term are the new propositions for the Social Security reform and definitely a privatization agenda, trying to reduce the government debt by selling some of these more kind of assets that the government owns.
How will the elites react to this president as compared to how they reacted to Mr. Lula a lifetime ago?
Tom, it's a great point. I think it's quite different in 2002 when we saw Lula coming on board. The elite was very negative on the country, thinking that it would be kind of a big problem for the country. And at the end of the day, Lula became really a president that helped out, especially around those years, for the country to grow. I think this time around is a little bit different. We're seeing the elite very positive with a more of a right-wing mentality government. And definitely the fact that he's bringing on board as ministers, very technical guys that have very strong private sector success. I think it's been probably the government that people have been giving a lot more hope that we've seen in this last decades.
Now, he just raised the minimum wage, correct?
Correct, yes. It was already expected to see that. The former President Temer was going to release that, but it was released immediately after. Not big news, this already kind of expected.
Will this help the domestic economy at all, or are people more concerned about corruption and crime?
Definitely this was an election about corruption and crime. We didn't see, I always say that Bolsonaro came as a representative of a cleaner government, not necessarily with a lot of his propositions. We're now seeing the propositions coming on board, and so far they've seen positive. But I think this was much more of an election of discussing. I'm not wanting the old corruption scheme of the old politics. Go ahead, Tom.
What's the opportunity here? I mean, for global investors, we look at Real. We have, I think, a highly simplistic view. But what is the domestic opportunity for international investors within this new Brazil?
I think it's a great question, because Brazil, if you add exports and imports, we don't even come up to 20% of the GDP. So really 80% of the story
it's
of
domestic.
Brazil is about domestic. Right? We've seen some of the stocks and some of the stories that are related to consumption going very well in these last year. I think we're going to be able to see more of that. We see consumption related, we see healthcare related, education. I think we will be able to see now that there's a lot of slack in the economy with a very high unemployment rate. We're going to be able to see some of these domestic stories coming on board. And I think that the wise investor will be able to select if he's going to go to public. There's some very kind of low PE multiples that are still kind of applying here in the market that you'll be able to buy them. I'm more of a private equity guy, as you guys know.
Yeah.
So I think there's some very kind of multi-year, possibly decade trends that are going to happen here that are quasi-no-brainers for us.
Can you give us one example?
Yeah, of course. So I've invested in a logistics company. Just to give you an idea, Amazon Prime is not present in Brazil. So in a country which is the fifth largest population in the world, fifth largest territory, we don't have just some time in logistics. There's no really delivery kind of
okay, so let's break some news here. Are you suggesting to Mr. Bezos, who listens religiously, are you suggesting to Mr. Bezos that he needs to come to Brazil?
Yeah, definitely. I think Mrs. Bezos will have a very hard time coming to Brazil without having a strategic logistics plan, because differently than the other countries, the logistics is not present here. Only 14% of the roads are paved here. So you need to have a different mindset of simply kind of building up a express company on top of a UPS or a FedEx structure. There's none here.
So this means that if Tom wants to get away from all the Amazon boxes, he can go and find Brazilian boxes in Brazil, but not Amazon boxes.
Yeah, but even the Brazilian boxes are very hard to get. You have a lot of regional players. You don't still have a national solution. So we ended up investing in a company that was the first one to use airlines, for instance. So
can you tell us the name of the company?
It's called Modern Logistics. Was founded by a former VP of JetBlue that founded Azul in Brazil, Gerald Lee.
We've interviewed him. Yeah, interesting. Well, I'm going to leave it there. Oscar Ticatelli, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it with DXA, a window into Brazil. And again, I'll say this a million times. You remember where you were wrong so much more than the little victories. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.